Welcome to Lumos Maxima, the Rolling Library Podcast. My name is Demi Schwartz, a Hufflepuff.
My name is Jessica Minacci, a Ravenclaw. It's time to turn on the light because Hogwarts is about to welcome you home.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 2 of Lumos Maxima. We are so excited to be back.
Yes, we are, and we are even more excited about y'all's responses on social media. So if you guys don't know, we have a Facebook page called Lumos Maxima, the Rolling Library Podcast, and we also have an Instagram and a Twitter, which is at Lumos Maxima Cast, where we post photos, polls, and all of the fun things. We've gotten such a good response on social. People have retweeted us, people have commented, people have even messaged me and Demi personally, which is just fantastic. Some of you even follow our personal accounts, which is just mind-blowing. So we want to say a huge thank you to all of you. You've made our day. I mean, we were just doing the podcast for fun and we didn't realize that you guys were gonna love it. We hoped you would, but we didn't expect this big of a response. So we're really happy and pleased, and we want to thank you so much. And Demi has a special shout out she'd like to give.
So special shout out to, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Viana. Her Twitter handle is Dumbleburn. You completely made my day when you tweeted us saying that you listened to the episode twice, and just in general, following us personally and engaging with us about not only the podcast, but things we're up to in our normal lives. You've just been just so sweet and so supportive. So special shout out to you. We're super grateful.
I'm pretty sure she's a Ravenclaw, so that makes it even better. But no, seriously, you made my day. So thank you. And we'll be doing more shout outs in the episodes to come. So definitely stay tuned for that.
Yeah. So today we are talking about one of my favorite things ever, which is the Deathly Hallows. And to make this even more special, we have a guest on with us, my friend Kathy.
Hi, everyone.
So Kathy is going to tell us a little bit about herself so y'all can get to know her better.
All right, so my house is Hufflepuff. My wand is fir wood with unicorn hair core, which is 10 inches. My Patronus is a brown owl. My favorite character is Professor Lupin, and I would honestly love to see a spinoff movie or just hear his full backstory, because I think that would be really interesting about him. I
feel like he's cool.
Yeah, right? I feel like he's a little misunderstood sometimes. My favorite book is Goblet of Fire, and my favorite Hogwarts class is Herbology. I feel like it would be really cool to learn about magical plants.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
And Sprout is head of Hufflepuff House, so that totally works. And shout out to us, because there are two puffs on the pod.
That's right.
I know, I'm outnumbered. Where am I even claws at? So you guys, Kathy is going to come back later on in the podcast during our Tales of Magic and Mischief segment to talk to us a little bit about the Hallows. It'll be awesome to have a unique perspective on the podcast, so we're really excited about that. But right now, let's dive into the recap of the latest issue of the Rolling Library magazine.
Let's take a glimpse into the articles in the latest issue of the Rolling Library magazine.
Let's delve deep into the March issue of the Rolling Library magazine, issue number 39. First, we have a character profile that highlights Lupin's bravery, and it's called Lupin's Most Gryffindor Moments. Then, we have an announcement about our podcast. We're famous. So, hopefully, this will lend us some new ears and listeners. We already have a bunch of listeners, but it's always awesome to get more. And then, we have an article about the new editions of the Harry Potter books. In a period of just a few months, Bloomsbury and Scholastic will release 6 new editions of Harry Potter books, collector's items per se. And then we have a St. Patrick's Day article written by your favorite Hufflepuff, Demi. It's called Ride the Rainbow Through the Harry Potter Series, and it talks about all of the colors in the series, which I think would be pretty interesting to read. And then we have a book review of One Day by David Nichols. And then finally, there's the Wizarding World crossword puzzle and the quote by Joe, which Demi is going to read for us.
So Joe's quote is about Lupin, and it says, Professor Lupin is a damaged person, literally and metaphorically. His being a werewolf is really a metaphor for people's reactions to illness and disability. And I think it's very ironic because at the start of this episode, Kathy was talking a little bit about how Lupin is misunderstood. And this quote definitely highlights that because Lupin is a werewolf. He is seen as an inferior race in the wizarding world, and he definitely faces a lot of challenges.
Yes, he does. And now, let's get into our Deathly Hallows quote.
It's time for Quick Quotes Corner.
So the quote I picked for the Deathly Hallows is from chapter 35 of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, which is called King's Cross. And this is something that Dumbledore tells Harry. I was scared that, if presented outright with the facts about those tempting objects, you might seize the hallows as I did, at the wrong time for the wrong reasons. If you laid hands on them, I wanted you to possess them safely. You are the true master of death, because the true master does not seek to run away from death. He accepts that he must die and understands that there are far, far worse things in the living world than dying. This quote is very significant because it shows that Dumbledore accepts his flaws. When he was younger, he and Grindelwald kind of became obsessed with the Hallows and believed that uniting them and becoming master of death would make them invincible. And this obsession that they had ultimately led to the big duel, and this resulted in Ariana's death. From this point forward, Dumbledore kind of took a step back and realized that he is not good with power. He even turned away being Minister of Magic several times. But on the other hand, when Harry faced Voldemort with a full intention of dying, that shows that he is true master of death because he realizes that it's not conquering death and being invincible, that it's accepting the fact that you are going to die and that you have to be mortal. And so this quote shows Dumbledore's flaws, and it also shows Harry's strength as a person.
I really like this quote also. I feel like it shows too how a lot of the times the mentor is teaching the person that he is mentoring about his mistakes and about how to avoid them. And that's part of Harry's learning curve. It's always been learning from Dumbledore and then realizing his and Dumbledore's mistakes and trying to become better and rise above them. And that's exactly what Harry is doing here. So I see the significance in this quote, and I think it's one of the best parts of the seventh book.
That is such an amazing perspective on this quote that I didn't think of. So I'm super glad that you brought that up. But next, I think Polly is here with some wizarding news.
Hey, it's Polly, our owl. She's bringing us the wizarding news in the Muggle world.
Hey guys, it's time for wizarding news in the Muggle world. Now, this first article is really special to me because it introduces the world of magic to kids who need it more than ever during the COVID-19 crisis. It is called Harry Potter at Home. The Wizarding World just released this hub on their website that they will be updating frequently for parents, teachers, caregivers, and students. This hub includes special articles, puzzles, quizzes, craft videos, and activity kits from Bloomsbury to Scholastic. In addition, J.K. Rowling has announced a special open license, which allows teachers to read the 7 books aloud on video to their students. The first book, narrated by Stephen Fry, is available for free on Audible's new platform, stories.audible.com. People can listen to it in English, French, Spanish, Italian, German, and Japanese. Pottermore Publishing will also be teaming up with Overdrive, allowing patrons to borrow the first book as an ebook or audiobook in over 20 languages from participating local and school libraries, including via Overdrive's Libby app and the Sora app for schools. This offering lasts until the end of April, so definitely take advantage of it. The next article we have is called Bloomsbury and Scholastic Reveal Covers for the New Illustrated Edition of Quidditch Through the Ages. According to the Wizarding World website, the full-color illustrated editions of Quidditch Through the Ages will be published simultaneously in hardback on October 6, 2020. The book is illustrated by Emily Gravett. The book will have match posters, team uniforms, Chudley Cannons, memorabilia, broom adverts, old Quidditch World Cup tickets, and more.
Along with the illustrations, the book also has Quidditch trivia, tales of on-pitch antics, team profiles, and talks about Quidditch moves. Proceeds go to the Lumos charity and comic relief efforts. Now let's go to Demi, who has the Deathly Hallows news.
So, in Deathly Hallows news, I want to first talk about the symbol. So, the symbol is a vertical line representing the Elder Wand, which has a circle around it representing the Resurrection Stone, and a triangle representing the Cloak of Invisibility encloses both line and circle. In 2017, BBC did a documentary called Harry Potter, A History of Magic, which J.K. Rowling talked about the inspiration behind the characters and series for the 20th anniversary of Sorcerer's Stone. During this documentary, she revealed the inspiration behind the Deathly Hallows symbol. One night, J.K. was watching The Man Who Would Be King while sketching Professor Sprout. At this time, she received a phone call that her mother had died. Years later, she watched the movie, and when she saw the Masonic symbol in the film, she realized that it was very similar to that of the Deathly Hallows, and she recognized on a subconscious level that the night she was watching the movie and learned of her mother's death was connected to the Deathly Hallows. Rowling says, "The Potter story is hugely about loss," and she also goes on to say that if her mother hadn't died, the story would have turned out much differently, and I think this is very interesting. Next, I want to talk a little bit about Dumbledore's notes in Tale to Beedle the Bard. So after each story in Tale to Beedle the Bard, Dumbledore kind of gives his insight into the story, and his notes following the Tale of the Three Brothers are very, very insightful. If you don't have the Tale to Beedle the Bard, totally get it. And the audiobook just came out, so listen to it because it's fantastic. So there are two things that he says that I want to touch on. First, he says that the moral of the story is humans' efforts to evade or overcome death are always doomed to disappointment. This is seen in the story because the oldest brother, who had the Elder Wand, believes that he can escape death through violence. The second brother, who has a Resurrection Stone, thinks that he can escape death through necromancy. And the third brother is the only one that kind of realizes that since he escaped death once, it's only a matter of time before death claims him. So Dumbledore also says that a tiny minority of the wizarding community persists in believing that Beedle was sending them a coded message, which is the exact reverse of the one set down in ink, and that they alone are clever enough to understand it. What he's talking about is the quest for the Hallows, and that if you unite them, it makes you master of death. So there are two points I want to make about this. First, the majority of the wizarding world takes the story for what it is and doesn't know or doesn't believe in the Hallows. There are a couple examples from the book that emphasize this. First, Ron was read the Tale of the Three Brothers by Molly when he was little, but though he knows about invisibility cloaks and tells Harry they're rare and valuable, he does not know it as a Hallow. Hermione, who's done tons of reading, never stumbled across the legend of the Deathly Hallows. Victor Crumb sees the symbol hanging around Xenophilius's neck at Bill and Fleur's wedding, but he calls it Grindelwald's sign, which kind of makes sense because Grindelwald was so closely tied to the Hallows, but Crumb doesn't recognize it as the Deathly Hallows symbol. Voldemort turned the Resurrection Stone into a Horcrux, so he definitely didn't know about the Hallows. And Ollivander, who knows about powerful wands, doesn't know about the Hallows either, because when Harry asked him about it, he said he never heard of them. Another point I want to make about what Dumbledore said is that he mentions that the people who believe in the Hallows quest think they're clever. And this is very interesting because Ravenclaws are the cleverest ones, and Xenophilius is Ravenclaw, and he believes in the Hallows quest. So I thought that was a very unique connection. And now let's go super deep into the Deathly Hallows with our guest, Kathy.
Now it's time to dive into the book topic of the week for Tales of Magic and Mischief.
So it is time to talk about the Deathly Hallows. Let's dive right into this because we have loads to talk about. So the Deathly Hallows are introduced in The Tale of the Three Brothers, which is one of the stories in Tale to Beedle the Bard. Hermione gets Dumbledore's copy of Tale to Beedle the Bard in his will, and the symbol is on the top of the page heading The Tale of the Three Brothers. And throughout the whole seventh book, before they discover what the Hallows are, the symbol pops up a lot. For example, Xenophilius is wearing it around his neck at Billenflare's wedding. It's on Ignotus Peverell's grave in Godric's Hollow. It's in the Life and Lives of Elvis Dumbledore biography that Rita Skeeter wrote. So this is popping up all over the place, and Hermione obviously wants to know what it is. So she suggests to go to Xenophilius's, and it's there when he basically says it all starts with the tale of the three brothers. So I'm going to read a short passage from the story. This is after the brothers wave their wands and make a bridge appear, and they're blocked by Death. And Death offers them gifts to kind of congratulate them for escaping being his victims. So here's a passage. So the oldest brother, who was a combative man, asked for a wand more powerful than any in existence, a wand that must always win duels for its owner, a wand worthy of a wizard who had conquered Death. So Death crossed through an elder tree on the bank of the river, fashioned a wand from a branch that hung there, and gave it to the oldest brother. Then the second brother, who was an arrogant man, decided that he wanted to humiliate Death still further, and asked for the power to recall others from Death. So Death picked up a stone from the riverbank and gave it to the second brother, and told him that the stone would have the power to bring back the dead. And then Death asked the third and youngest brother what he would like. The youngest brother was the humblest and also the wisest of the brothers, and he did not trust Death. So he asked for something that would enable him to go forth from that place without being followed by Death. And Death, most unwillingly, handed over his own cloak of invisibility. So those are the Deathly Hallows, the Elder Wand, the Resurrection Stone, and the Cloak of Invisibility. And Xenophilius tells the trio all about the quest. Jess, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
So the three of them are there. They read the tale. And Xenophilius tells them that he believes that the Deathly Hallows are real. And the Deathly Hallows are the three things that the brothers get from Death in the Tale of the Three Brothers. And Hermione is like, well, how are these things real? And Xenophilius says, well, they are. I mean, believers of the Deathly Hallows are always on a quest for them. And he talks about how there is a history of powerful wands, which could be the same one, it could be the Elder Wand, and how there are invisibility cloaks that are made with a disillusionment charm, but they often fade over time and stop working. There's no mention in history of the stone, so that's where Hermione thinks she's got him. She's like, they don't exist because the stone, there's no mention of one. And he's like, well, you never know. Like, there are a lot of things that can't be explained. And Hermione's just like, nah, they don't exist. But Harry and Ron are like, I think this could be a thing. I mean, what, you know, we've seen anything and everything in the magical world. Why can't this be there? So the three of them talk afterwards about which hollow they would choose. And so we're going to start with the first one, the Elder Wand. And Kathy, who chooses the Elder Wand as their chosen hollow?
Yeah, so out of the three, Ron chooses the Elder Wand, and he calls it the Unbeatable Wand, so that could be the reason why he chose it. If anybody's curious, the Elder Wand is 15 inches, with Elderwood, and it is made with Thestral Hair Core, which Ooh. Is something I actually didn't know.
That's so cool. I didn't know
Isn't
that.
It? I mean, honestly, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's so cool because, you know, Ollivander only uses dragon heartstring, unicorn hair, and phoenix feathers. So that's super cool that it has a different core. My mind's blown. I didn't know that.
I know. When I was looking that up, I was like geeking out. I was like, that is really cool.
That's so cool.
I mean, because thestrals are what you see after someone dies.
So it makes
that's
sense.
That's so cool.
And it makes sense. Isn't that's genius.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
Shout out to the first brother.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that's so cool. Kathy, why do you think Ron chose it? Just because it's unbeatable?
Yeah, I think sometimes, like, especially in the Hollows book, I mean, I feel like sometimes Ron was driven by power, And I feel like he was a little power hungry. So I could see why he chose the wand, because, I mean, trying to outshine Harry is, I mean, a hard task to do. So if you have the most powerful wand, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that is the reason why.
Yeah. And he definitely sticks with that feeling, because at the end, when Harry, after he defeats Voldemort, Harry uses the Elder Wand to repair his Phoenix Wand, and he tells Dumbledore's portrait, like, I'm going to put this back where I got it. And even Ron's like, but isn't it a beautiful wand, Harry?
Yeah,
like, keep
that's
it.
True.
Like, he's so stuck on that. Yeah.
That's very true. I didn't even think about that, but
yeah.
But at the times of the books, Dumbledore obviously had the wand.
Mm-hmm.
And Voldemort wanted the wand because it is all powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So what I thought was also interesting, which it does explain in the book, but the wand loyalty is different than the other wands. I was looking up online, and J.K. Rowling said that the Elder Wand knows no loyalty except to strength. So that basically means that you would have to win a battle against or disarm the owner to gain the loyalty of the wand. So I also thought that was really interesting, although it does explain it in the books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the wand really doesn't choose the wizard.
Right.
Yeah, it kind of
chooses
power.
The wand.
And it chooses power. Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah. So that is all I have for the Elder Wand.
Yeah, I love it. And I think it's also very interesting that the whole thing with Dumbledore's plan, you know, when he intended Snape to kill him, he intended Snape to get it, is what I'm guessing, because that's what he planned. But that doesn't work out, which is what Harry kind of confronts Voldemort with at the end when they're at Malfoy Manor. Harry disarms Draco, and Draco was the one who disarmed Dumbledore. So Draco, for a period of time, was the owner of the Elder Wand, even though he didn't physically have it, which is really cool, too, that even though he didn't physically have it because it was buried with Dumbledore at the time, that wand noticed or recognized that its allegiance had changed, even though it didn't actually change hands physically. So Draco was the owner of that, and then when Harry disarmed him, he was the rightful owner, which is why when Voldemort stole it from Dumbledore's grave, it didn't change allegiance to him, because Malfoy was it, and then Harry took it from him. So
yeah,
I thought that was interesting too.
That was very interesting. So actually Snape had never had the loyalty of the wand.
No.
So yeah, that is very interesting. I never thought about that.
So question, because I'm sort of a noob, does that mean if the wand isn't loyal to Snape, if he tried to use it, it wouldn't have worked, right?
Yeah, so that's kind of what happened to Voldemort. So when I forget when he was battling somebody with the Elder Wand, was it Harry?
Well, it was one at the end when they were doing each other. And Voldemort casted Avada Kedavra,
yes.
And then Harry did Expelliarmus.
Yes.
That wand would not kill Harry because Harry was the true owner. So when the spells rebounded, the wand flew out of his hand and landed in Harry's.
Yes, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but even now, like, even before, when Voldemort, that's why Voldemort brought Snape to the Shrieking Shack, because he said, this wand isn't working for me as it should. I took it from Dumbledore. It's not working for me as it should. So even though, like, we didn't see on the page what he was doing with that Elder Wand, it wasn't working for him. So yeah, thanks for all the Elder Wand stuff. Like, that's super interesting. My mind's blown over the core. Like, that.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that crazy?
I think it's
obvious, but it's not. Like,
yeah,
it's not,
I know,
obvious.
Right?
Like,
I know. Once I saw it and I read it, and I was like, oh my gosh, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now I think it's time for the Resurrection Stone, Jess.
I picked this one to talk about because I was just very intrigued. So Harry picked the Resurrection Stone. Now, you would think that it'd be obvious why Harry chose it, right? He didn't have a normal childhood with his family. He didn't get to see them every day. And the second brother has it. And we we learn that he used it to get his loved one back. So he lives with this person, his almost wife, and he, you know, death obviously comes to claim him in the end. So, you know, Harry could have thought, hey, if I have this for the rest of my life, I could technically live with my parents for the rest of my life, which would be cool. It would be cool, but obviously the parents are dead, so they could never age with Harry. They would just be there. I'd kind of be in some, like, strange limbo kind of. And it would also be kind of sad in a way. Like, I know why he chose it, because he desired it, but if he chose to be, like, the second brother and live among the dead, it's almost as if, like, after a while, like, you would feel dead yourself, wouldn't you?
Yeah, the second brother actually committed suicide.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, my point exactly. So, that's why I thought it was interesting how Harry chose it, because I was like, well, he'd want to live with his parents, but then it would almost be like being dead yourself.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, but Harry has a lot of friends around him, and he has more reason to live and more people to see. So, I think that's why, and I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to when Harry left it in the forest at the end of the book. So he left it not only because he didn't want to be the master of death and have them all, but because he realized that he could still live without his parents. It was seeing Sirius, Lupin, and his parents in the forest right before he confronts Voldemort is kind of his last way of grieving before he decides to basically die. So it just kind of ends it for him, and it's really interesting because JK has this happen where characters go full circle. And so I thought all of that was interesting, all of that was relevant to Harry's story, and it ended it in such a unique way. But as far as the stone itself, history goes that it was with Voldemort's grandfather.
Marvolo Gaunt, yes.
Yeah,
it was on his ring.
So it is with his grandfather on his ring, which Voldemort made into a Horcrux that Dumbledore obviously destroyed with the basilisk venom that was on the Sword of Gryffindor from when Harry killed the basilisk in the Chamber of Secrets. So basilisk venom, if you guys don't know, kills Horcruxes. But with Dumbledore, I don't know if he knew this or if he just accepted the fact that this might be cursed, but he put it on his hand and he had not much longer to live, which I think is kind of an oxymoron if you think about it, because it's like, you know, the stone lets you see the dead, but then the curse makes you almost become one of them.
Yeah.
Wow. So I thought that was good. Really cool. That was really cool. I was like, whoa, my mind is blown.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, good thing Harry didn't get the ring. It's one of the last things Dumbledore did to protect him, to be honest. And then what I also found fascinating is that I don't believe that Voldemort understood the whole history of the Hallows.
He did not know about the Deathly Hallows.
Right. And here's why. The reason why is he knew about the wand. He knew that it was a powerful wand. He might not have connected that it was a Hollow, because if he had known that the Hallows existed, he wouldn't have created the Horcruxes to conquer death. And so it's also kind of ironic that a Hollow that's supposed to help him conquer death was made into something else that was supposed to help him conquer death, which was the Horcrux.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's just like, OMG. So I was mind blown with that too when I was doing my research about this.
So I just think it's very interesting how, I didn't want to say what you're talking, but it kind of came to my mind when you're talking, that when he left the stone in the forest, that was like his last kind of thing with his parents, which he kind of realized that he didn't need the stone, you know. But that made me think of the Mirror of Erised. When he looked in the Mirror of Erised, he saw his parents for the first time. And I think it's very interesting that, like, having that experience in the first book and Dumbledore telling him that mirror is no good, I'm going to move it. I trust you. Don't go looking for it again. And Harry had a desire to go looking for it again, but he didn't. And I think at the end of these books, when Harry decides, you know, I'm going to leave the stone there, it kind of shows his strength as a person from that moment where he wanted to badly look in the mirror of Erised to when he had an object that he could carry around with him and see his parents and he decided not to. So I just think that's a very ghost character. Yeah.
Ooh, I was going to say, remind me what Ron sees in the mirror of Erised, because I think I have a point I want to make.
He sees himself, head boy, Quidditch captain, just with all of his brother's accomplishments, basically, because he was overshadowed.
So the power desire runs deep even from the first mm-hmm. book.
Wow, yeah, that's true. That's very true.
Yeah. And also one more thing about the stone is that I think it was very interesting that Dumbledore hid it in the Snitch because Harry, that his first ever Quidditch match, he almost swallowed it. So when Scrimgeour gave him the Snitch, he tells him that it has flesh memory. So anybody who touches it, the first person who to touch the Snitch would recognize their touch. So it didn't open when he touched it, but since he almost swallowed it, when he put his mouth to it, I opened at the close, is what it said on the Snitch. So
and then when he was when he was ready to die, he said, "I'm ready to die," and the Snitch opened.
Yeah.
Which also, might I add, the point I was going to say and I forgot was that Harry realized that to be the master of death, he has to master his mortality. So he has to be okay with dying. So mm-hmm. he had to be okay with the fact that since he was one of the Horcruxes, he had to die in some way, shape, or form.
And the Snitch too, my mind's just going like all in directions right now. I think the Snitch is kind of symbolic in a way, because even in the book, like right before he does that whole like I'm about to die and puts it to his mouth instead of at the close, the narrative says something along the lines of the game is over, the Snitch had been caught. So I feel like the whole thing tied back to like Quidditch, like when you catch the Snitch, that's the end of the game is over. So it's so symbolic that the stones and that Snitch, that when he opened it up, that's the end. Like the game's over, I'm about life to die, I got the stone.
Life is over.
Wow. Mm-hmm. My mind's blown.
I know. All right.
Look at us.
As they say, all of the players in the unfinished game are there, mm-hmm. right? So he's at the end of the game. He's at the end of the unfinished game, the players mm-hmm. being Hermione and Ron and him and Voldemort and everybody else who's in the Battle of Hogwarts.
All right, so let's move on to the cloak before I can go off again. okay, so Hermione picks the cloak. Honestly, I would too. Come on, who wouldn't want that? So I feel like Hermione picking it, it just shows her sensibility. When Ron and Harry are saying they want the wand and the stone, Hermione's like, well, this cloak has helped us, you know, she's saying like, we've seen like this cloak has helped us, like this is the most logical hallow, you know. And I agree, because what I'm about to get into here, throughout these books, if they didn't have this invisibility cloak, they wouldn't have been able to do 90% of the things they did. But okay, so the cloak is a third hallow. It was descended from Ignotus Peverell. It was passed down the generations to Harry. Harry is descended from Ignotus Peverell. Dumbledore took it into his possession because he suspected what it was. And Dumbledore is this all-powerful wizard. He doesn't need a spell to become invisible. So he didn't need this cloak. But he took it to analyze it because he believed it was a hallow. And he gave it to Harry for Christmas, his first year at Hogwarts, with a note telling him to use it well. And boy, do they do. So this cloak is, as just mentioned earlier, there are other visibility cloaks with disillusionment charms, bedazzling hexes, demigod's hair actually is invisible too, but it becomes opaque with time. But this cloak is a hallow that truly and really renders the wearer invisible. It's eternal. It it's constantly giving impenetrable concealment. Like, this is a perfect cloak. And so throughout the books, they use it loads of times. So I'm just going to list from each book kind of what they do, and we can kind of discuss a little bit about what they use it for and if we think that they could have possibly done this without it. So they use it at the end of Sorcerer's Stone to go to the trap door and follow what they believe is Snape, which is actually Professor Quirrell. So do you guys really think that they would have been able to do that without the cloak?
No.
No way.
No. Yeah, so yeah, there's no way. So, and then in Chamber of Secrets, they use it when, after Hermione is petrified, and Harry goes into Riddle's diary and basically is fooled into believing that Hagrid opened the Chamber of Secrets 50 years ago. So Harry and Ron go down to Hagrid thinking, like, we got to talk to him right now. So they wear the cloak, they sneak out of the castle, they go down in the cloak, and then when they're there, Cornelius Fudge, Dumbledore, and Lucius Malfoy show up. So Harry and Ron are just kicking it in the corner under the invisibility cloak while these three come in. Basically, when they're there, Dumbledore gets kicked out as headmaster, Hagrid's getting sent to Azkaban, and when they're there and they hear Dumbledore say his famous line, help will always be given at Hogwarts to those who ask for it. And then Hagrid, as he's leaving, yells back to them, if anyone wants to know some stuff, all you have to do is follow the spiders. And they actually do use the invisibility cloak when they go to the Aragog. So if they didn't have the invisibility cloak and Fudge, Dumbledore, and Malfoy would have walked in, they would have been in huge trouble.
Well, yeah, and they wouldn't have heard what Dumbledore... No. Mm-mm. And Hagrid said, so they would have nothing, you know? So I feel like that was very important for them to be there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of books, when you read them, you have different plot devices to move it forward, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, you know, a lot of times information is found through eavesdropping, especially in these books. So if they weren't there to eavesdrop, the plot wouldn't have been able to move along for them to follow the spiders.
That's true.
So the fact, so it's just also a plot device.
Yeah, definitely.
So is symbolic in that it's not just invisible, but it's almost like it's a living thing that helps them move through the story.
Yeah.
It's like and
it's like
and
part of them. It's like trio part number four, quadruplets.
It is. It's a living thing, and that's why it's a hollow. Like, these hollows are almost like living things.
Yeah, so moving on to Prisoner of Azkaban, they use it when, Harry obviously uses it. This isn't like a major plot thing, but it's hilarious when he, like, goes to Hogsmeade under the cloak. And I love it when he's, like, at the Shrieking Shack and, like, Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle are up there and they're playing tricks on him. Like he's throwing mud at them and, like, just scaring the crap out of them. And it slips and Malfoy sees his head, like, floating in midair and, like, it's freaked out and runs away. I just love that. And obviously Snape is like, what is your head doing in Hogsmeade, Potter? No part of your body is allowed in Hogsmeade. But, yeah, I thought that was really funny. But
I love it because in the movie he's like, I saw something, I swear. And they're like, Draco, nothing's there. Like, it's
the best part. More seriously, they use it when they find out that Buckbeak is about to be executed. They wear it down to Hagrid's. And then when they think Buckbeak is executed, but we find out with the whole time turning thing that he isn't. But they're still under the cloak when Scabbers, a.k.a. Peter Pettigrew, leaps away from Ron. And Ron chases after him. This is when Sirius in dog form comes. And they actually leave the cloak at the base of the Romping Willow when they go in. Snape gets it. And when they're in the Shrieking Shack and Lupin and Sirius are swinging everything, Snape's just, like, chilling outside the room with the cloak on, listening. So, in a way, this time, like, I get why they used the cloak going down to Hagrid's because they didn't want to be seen. But in a way, like, this kind of backfired a little bit because they left it there and Snape got it.
Yeah, I kind of forgot that Snape got it.
Yeah.
But that I feel like that's pretty important for him to hear in. Wow. Mm. Oh, I never thought about that.
Yeah, it's like another instance where it's a plot device, and Prisoner of Azkaban is my favorite book. It has a big place in my heart, especially the Buckbeak scenes. So they definitely needed that. And also, like, Weren't they under the invisibility cloak as the other three were going around?
Oh, yeah, that was, when they went back, to get when they to Buffy. Did the time turner. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like, so the three could have saw the other three if they didn't have it on, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Couldn't well, they did see them at one point when they took it off, but initially they didn't because they had the cloak on. How weird is that? Like you're in two places at once and you know that's you, but you can't see yourself because you have the cloak on.
Yeah, that's what weird. I think is really kind of cool about it is, like, that was the one time where it was, like, so parallel. Like, they were parallel to each other. They heard it and then they didn't mm-hmm. see it, which is kind of cool.
And I think in Goblet of Fire, Kathy's favorite book, he uses the cloak in two very significant times that if he didn't have the cloak, there's no way. First was when Hagrid showed him the dragons for the first task. He was under the invisibility cloak when Hagrid went to get Madame Maxime to show her. Harry was there too, so he saw that. And the other time was when after the Yule Ball, Cedric said to kind of get equal with Harry for sharing the news about the dragons. He said, take the egg for a bath. Use the prefect's bathroom. He tells them the password and everything. And Harry is sneaking through the castle with the invisibility cloak to get to the prefect's bathroom to open the egg underwater. So those two times, like, he really, like, that cloak helped him with the Triwizard Tournament.
That's true.
All right, so then in Order of the Phoenix, he uses it twice to get into Umbridge's office. The first time was after he saw Snape's memory in the Pensieve about, like, when his dad was using Levicorpus and they were all bullying him and stuff. Like, he just felt super bothered by this whole thing because he idolized his dad so much. So he snuck into Umbridge's office, used her fire to speak to Sirius and Lupin about that. And then later, after he had the tortured vision of Sirius, he and Hermione used the cloak to go into the office too. So those are two really significant places too. And then Half-Blood Prince had a lot. So he used the cloak a bunch of times basically to sneak up on Malfoy to see what he was doing. They followed him into Nocturne Alley to see what he was doing in Borgin and Burks. Harry used it in the compartment on the Hogwarts Express to hear what Draco was telling the other Slytherins. He used it at Slughorn's Christmas party when Snape and Malfoy went into the other room. Then he also kept trying to use it to get into the room of requirement. So I feel like this him using a cloak for that, like, it was kind of more of, like, the mischief, like, rule-breaking kind of thing. Because he was doing a lot of stuff, like, in school, like, going to the room of requirement when he wasn't supposed to and stuff. But that helped him a lot. And then the sad part that gets me is when Dumbledore died, when he basically used his a second before Draco disarmed him to freeze Harry, and Harry's under the invisibility cloak. Imagine Harry under the invisibility cloak, seriously just standing there and watching Snape kill Dumbledore, being frozen and invisible and not being able to help.
Yeah, that part is sad.
Oh, it is.
It makes me cry every time. I mean, obviously the reason being that he had to be frozen was because Snape had to get the wand.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it all kind of comes full circle, but it just taught me to love and appreciate reading, and even the decisions that the author makes that I don't like,
you come to
accept them. And it also makes you love the book even more. Like, as sinister as that sounds, you know?
Yeah, after reading for so long, especially these books, you get so attached to the characters.
Yeah.
And then when something happens to them, if they die, if they get hurt, you're just like, oh my gosh. And your heart breaks. But it really does. That's what tells the story. It does, you know? So it's heartbreaking,
but it
is a part of the story.
Mm-hmm. And then in the last book, Deathly Hallows, this is when they really depended on the cloak for literally everything. Every time they ended up just apparating underneath it when they were changing locations. They would use it when they had to go get food. They used it when they went to the ministry, it said 4 weeks they rotated on and off, like the three of them going to the ministry and observing for 4 weeks under the invisibility cloak. There's no way they would have been able to do that without it. And then they also, Harry used it when they went to Gringotts to get Hufflepuff's cup. Harry and Luna used it when they went to Ravenclaw Tower to see the replica of the diadem. Harry used it when they went to the Shrieking Shack and he saw Snape die. Harry used it when they went into the he went into the forest at the end, which I think is crazy because, like, he at the very end when Judge was talking about the stone and everything, Harry's wearing the cloak, so he had one of the Hallows on. He was holding the other one, and though he didn't know it, he was the possessor of the Elder Wand because he disowned Draco. So it's so weird that, like, he was kind of in that moment, like, when he was facing his own death, like, he was expecting to die, which makes him Master of Death, because Master of Death is recognizing that you do die and overcoming that fear. But he was kind of the possessor of all three when he died, honestly, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. So, going back full circle for the three, talking about the stone and the wand and the invisibility cloak, we obviously know from all three why all three of them chose it. And if Hermione is the brightest witch of her age, that's why she chose the invisibility cloak. Mm-hmm. Ron was power hungry. Harry obviously needed to see his loved ones. So, mm-hmm. which Hollow would each of you have chosen to have if you could have it?
I would have to go with the cloak.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like it is the smartest decision out of the three. I mean, and it really just depends on what kind of person you are too. But I feel like I would just use it in my life. I love to gossip. Or not, I love to listen in, and, like, I would wonder what people, like, thought about me, or, like, what they're saying. I mean, like, I would totally go Harry and Hermione and Ron and bring my friends, and we'd go around everywhere and listen to everybody's conversations. I think that would be awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I would definitely go with the cloak.
Yeah, me too. And I feel like out of every single magical object, like, these books have cool things, but, like, out of every single one, like, the cloak is, like, the coolest thing I want to have. And, like, honestly, like, we all have those moments where we're like, oh, I just wish I was invisible. I wish I could sing it to the ground. And you had to be like, you know what, guys, I'm just throwing this cloak over my head, goodbye. So, like, I feel like anything, like, personal reasons, gods have been, like, if you want to just go somewhere, like, even, like, Harry, you know, like, the one time you went to might have been Goblet of Fire the one time when they went to Hogsmeade and, like, everybody was gossiping about him, and he's like, I want to go and have a good time, but I don't want everybody looking at me, so I'm just gonna, you know, tell Hermione I'm under this and I'm just gonna wear it, you know. So, like, I feel like it's a good fallback for, like, those kind of things.
So you guys kind of covered what I was gonna say about the cloak also, but I think the main thing that I would use the cloak for if I did use it would be kind of just to, like, travel on my own. Like, to just go around and just kind of see the world on my own without being bothered by anybody else.
Yeah.
So kind of just, like, your own, like, the whole journey of solitude thing. Like,
mm-hmm.
that would be me.
Yeah.
And honestly, so if you know me, you know that when I read a book, if I'm at a great part and you interrupt me, I'm very mean to you. I'm very mean to you. And I apologize afterwards, but I am usually very mean. So I would just kind of go into a library, put on the cloak, and just read underneath it and not be bothered. It's such a dumb and boring way to use it. I mean, gossiping is fun, but, like, I just think that's what I'd use it for, too.
I agree.
Fantastic reason. That's beautiful. I'd also use it for that. That's a great reason.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
I'm going to steal that.
So, guys, yeah, the cloak's the best one. 3-3 here.
Yeah.
Don't you guys find it ironic that, like, the three of them couldn't agree on one, but we can? I guess that's just shows our different personalities, which is kind of cool. So we are about through with our discussion. It was a lot longer than our first episode, but we hope you've enjoyed it. We want to thank Kathy for being our guest.
Did you enjoy it, Kathy? Yeah, it's been a blast, and whenever you want to come back on, I would love to come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, we would both definitely have you back. You're awesome.
Thank you.
So guys, literally, let us know what Hallow you would pick and why. And yeah, thank you so much for listening to us talk about all this. We had a lot of fun, and yeah, thank you for tuning in again, and we can't wait to be back in 2 weeks on April 24th with our third episode.
We also can't wait to have more guests on our
We're gonna try to have guests on like every time, and eventually we definitely want to have our biggest listeners on. So if you guys are interested, let us know like some of your favorite things in Harry Potter, and we'll definitely keep you in mind because we want to include our listeners too.
It'll also be even better if you come up to us and say, I have an idea for an episode, then we'll be like, cool, we love it, can you guess?
So, thanks
again guys for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thank you for coming back to Hogwarts with us in this episode of Lumos Maxima, the Rolling Library podcast.
Hedwig's theme and Leaving Hogwarts in this episode were originally composed by John Williams and arranged by your favorite Hufflepuff.
Until next time, 3,
2,
1,
Knox.